Hello and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this episode of Word Magazine, I have a guest with me. He is Vince Krivda. And so I welcome Vince to the Word Magazine podcast. Vince, welcome to the Word Magazine podcast.
Thanks, Jeff. I'm happy to be here.
Good to have you here. You and I first met, I think, in 2019 down in Atlanta. You attended the Texan Canon Conference. And then last year, we crossed paths again at the Kept Pure in All Ages Conference in Wisconsin. And I certainly enjoyed getting the chance to meet you and learn a little bit more about you. And so thanks so much for coming on to be a guest today. In this episode, one of the things we want to do is I want to talk about an article that Vince wrote about a year and a half ago. And he wrote this article. The title of it is Which Texas Receptus? Subtitled A Response to Mark Ward's Critique of Confessional Bibliology. And so I want Vince to share with us a little bit about that article, how he came to write it, and you know what the thesis of it is, what response he's gotten to it. So that's going to be the subject of our conversation today. But before we do that, I want to learn a little bit more about Vince. So Vince, let's take a few moments here for you to just tell us about who you are. Like, where do you live? What do you do? How did you come to the faith? So let me just turn it over to you and tell our listeners to this podcast a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Jeff. So I am an artist here in Columbus, Ohio, but I travel a lot. So I'm a visual artist, but also like a performing artist. So I'm probably not like your conventional guest here on the show, but I feel like that is really exciting to me to have this opportunity because I might have a little bit of an outsider insight to some of these issues. I'm not like that vocal about text and textual issues and that kind of thing, at least not that much anymore. I've been focusing more on the performance art. I do like, basically I go to concerts and musical events where I'll like perform with the band or whoever the musicians are. And I just like start with a blank canvas and then just kind of improvise to the music and then I'll produce something. So lately I have been getting a lot of like good big gigs and that kind of thing, a lot of internet attention. So that's fun. But to me, like my artistic journey, it does stem from my religious faith. And I guess a little bit about that. When I was a kid, I just remember that I was given a Bible very early, and I just loved to read. And my Bible is something that I would just read until I fell asleep and wake up. It'd be right there in my chest, and I might like want to pick up where I left off and that kind of thing. So I feel like my calling to the faith was seated very early. I kind of grew up in like a Presbyterian environment. I was baptized. Kind of paradoxically, I was baptized when I was a teenager. I went through a confirmation class in the PCA and all that. And so I was baptized a little bit after I had given my profession of faith. And so, but I do think I have like a confessional background, Westminster Confession of Faith. And I do like appreciate not just confessions, but the old writings from the Reformed and the Reformed dogmatists. And I feel like I've grown from that heritage more than anything else. I am kind of in a transitional period though with my membership at a church. And so, but I still have a lot of sympathy for people outside of the Reformed faith and having fellowship with people that love the Bible and have that zeal for the Bible like me.
Thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's so interesting because I think if somebody thinks of, you know, somebody who cares about the text of scripture, they're probably not going to think of a visual and performance artist. You know what I mean? They would think that they're right. Probably thinking you're the kind of person that modern translations are made for, you know?
Oh, right.
You should be reading the Message, Vince. Don't you understand? You should like something, you know, relevant for you or whatever. I mean, it is interesting. Did you grow up in Ohio, Columbus area?
Yeah, I've grown up here in Columbus, Ohio. I was in the military for a little bit, so I traveled the world and did that kind of thing. And I decided I wanted to come back and I wanted to take a stab at art. But yeah, it's been enriching in Columbus.
Is the visual art you do mainly painting? Is that what the medium you work in?
It's traditional painting. So I mostly do like an acrylic style that is fast drying because I want to have something that's done by the end of the musical performance. So I'm like collaborating with them. And then I have to have something done at the time. And then like on the off season, I do work on like custom work. So sometimes you'll see that on my social media stuff. I'll have something that it was somebody's idea that they wanted me to paint and put my like signature background and all that. But I mainly am focusing on the live painting. And it's cool that you brought that up, that I'm not like the typical person that would be interested in subjects like the text of the Bible. But I feel like where I'm at, I do have a way to relate to people that might not be reached otherwise by the gospel. It's there's little ways that I can relate to people, but also bring them a little bit of God's love and his charity. And also being able to give them insight, but also I think it informs my like outsider background too. I'm able to, when I talk about text or with others, I think I'm drawing a lot of my philosophical background. And so I think that there are some insights that I wanted to talk about with this article that would give kind of like a positive contribution to the textual conversation.
Well, we're going to, by the end, I'm going to make sure when I post this to Word Magazine online, I'm going to do a corresponding article at my website, jeffriddle.net, and I'll put a link so that you can read the article. The article is on Vince's academia.edu page. And I mean, it's a sophisticated article. And I mean, just curious about that, because, I mean, it's a pretty good academic paper. I mean, you've got some training in somewhere along the way in doing academic writing and some theological training. How did you pick that up along the way?
I think mostly from my undergrad experience. I went to Capital University in Columbus and I did do like a philosophy thesis. But I think what happened was I just got really interested in reading some of the scholarly work on the issue because it's just how I investigate things. I want to know what the conversation is on the critical side of things, on the historical critical perspective, what is being published, but also like what is the theology that's underpinning like the development of the church, what types of advances theologically has the church been making in these days. Sometimes there's like a reactionary pull on both sides of the stream from like a canonical perspective compared to like a critical thought perspective. Sometimes there's like a exchange there that I think is really interesting. And that is, so I guess like most of it has been just reading some of the material, that the literature that's out there. And when I research like the footnotes and all that thing, I feel like I'm just getting more understanding of how that works. And with this article, I did want to do some work. I wanted to do the work for like a contribution so that, you know, you could look at my work cited and then either like check up on that or like just have a bibliography for I think stuff that's relevant about the issues. So I wanted to have that available for people.
I mean, one of the things I appreciated about your article was that you're kind of towards the end, especially, you're asking some really interesting questions related to, I think, the philosophy of media. And maybe we'll come to this at the end about the transition from into a print culture. You had some really interesting insights about that. And I think, from the perspective, knowing that you're an artist, a visual artist, performing artist, and you're interested in medium, you made some interesting points about, and we'll talk about that maybe at the end. I don't know if you know this or not. I have a daughter who is a professional graphic designer / artist.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I don't know how she got the talent, but anyway, she enjoys painting and doing watercolors and so forth. And so she's added an artist perspective to our family. So anyways, that's cool.
That's interesting.
So let's talk about the article. Let's go ahead and turn. Now, you wrote this article. Again, the subtitle of it is A Response to Mark Ward's Critique of Confessional Bibliology. So Mark Ward is a pretty outspoken critic, particularly of the King James Version, the Authorized Version. And he, I guess 2 years ago in 2020, I know he did a lecture at a seminary that was sort of critiquing confessional bibliology. And then he followed that up with an article that appeared in the Detroit Baptist Seminary Journal in the summer of 2020. And his article was titled "Which Texas Receptus: A Critique of Confessional Bibliology," and so I guess you could say he sees it as a major weak spot in the confessional bibliology position that he can say, well, which TR is it that you think is the authoritative one, and so forth. And so then, pretty quickly you wrote this article within a couple of months after this. I think it came out, what was it, in August? Like his journal came out in like June, and then you wrote your article in August. So why did you feel compelled to write this article and respond to Mark Ward?
Well, I did have an interest in his book, and I had a little bit of a correspondence with him about the King James Version, and I had done some work and like raised some issues and questions to him, and that I thought might be like a nice conversation. And I guess I felt like that he wasn't getting the serious attention that I think his work, even though it was like more of a popular level thing that, probably had some mischaracterizations that needed to be dealt with, I still thought that it was like a thoughtful, serious attempt to deal with this confessional bibliology thing. And I just thought it wasn't. So I had been talking with him, and then when the article came out, he showed me the article right when it came out, and I knew that it was a pressing, important issue. But like the way I think of the article is, it's not only a response to Mark Ward. It is like an occasion to talk about this debate in the conversation, and I thought this matter about which TR, I feel like that is one of the core issues. Like, it gets to the nub of the matter. It really is a chance. When that issue is brought up, it can be an opportunity and a chance for someone from a confessional background to really clarify what they mean. And say, well, this is why we can't accept your critique because you're getting this part wrong. And that is a great chance, I think, to really express like what we mean. So there was all those things, and I don't know. I feel like I might have a different reaction to Mark Ward than I think most people from a confessional background. Mm-hmm. I somewhat feel the charm. You know, I love reading his writing, and I love disagreeing with it. It's it's easy to understand. It really gets to the point and is somewhat provocative. And I just wanted to talk about it. But it's not just about responding to him. It's that occasion where I can say, "Hey, guys, we need to address this issue. I can. This is like my take on it." But I also wanted to point out that maybe there needs to be some systematic or some kind of like theoretical development that underpin a confessional theory, if you will, about what the text of scripture is.
Yeah. Well, you definitely were very charitable in the article, and you did a good job. You were very balanced. And yeah, you said here's some positive things about Mark Ward's critique. But on the other hand, you also, you know, pointed out here's some problems I perceive with his critique. And we'll get to this at the end. I mean, you also address advocates of the confessional text like me a little bit and have some suggestions for us as well.
But sure. I think the mood at the time was a little tense in the conversation. And I felt that there was a lot of people responding to Mark Ward, but I feel like the tone, it's not that it wasn't seeking to understand his position. I mean, a lot of what I was reading from the confessional point of view was right on target and found some really clever ways to point out where he was wrong. But I feel like the tone just created this atmosphere where conversation could not happen. And I know I got some criticism about being a little too nice to him, or I mean, I guess like charitably trying to understand what he's saying. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, we don't have to have any kind of conversation with a critical perspective. But I feel like a conversation like this from two sides can be fruitful. It can force us to explain what we mean a little bit more clearly.
Good. Those are good points. And yeah, I mean, I always say that, you know, and I've erred sometimes in sometimes being, you know, overly acerbic and responding to criticisms and so forth. Particularly with a certain popular internet apologist, but
sure.
But sure. At any rate, yeah, I think it does help our cause if we can be charitable, and it also, you know, helps our cause if we're not slinging out ad hominems and instead we're meeting, you know, reasonable objections with reasonable responses. And
The great thing is that you don't really have to rely on ad hominems with him. Sometimes you really can point out that you're just like getting us wrong and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So with respect to your article, can you summarize the thesis of your article, you know, in a brief span, two or three sentences or so?
Sure. I guess how I'd summarize it is, well, how about one sentence can be the antithesis of his thesis that the confessional bibliology and a critical text position that he says that they may differ in degree, but not in kind. And so, like, I take some effort to say, well, not only are they different in degree, but those two positions are fundamentally different in kind. You can't fairly compare them and just say one's just another extreme of the other. And that's what I make an effort to do. So I'd say that that is one of the thrusts of my paper, is to just refute that. But then I guess what I'd also say is that this paper is meant to say that that the confessional text position needs to recognize the that the media is an important focus to have any kind of further development on this issue.
I mean, just there might be somebody listening who really is kind of, this is a new topic. I mean, just to summarize Ward's critique, is to say, so the confessional bibliology position says, instead of pursuing the reconstructed modern critical text, we should instead rely on, with respect to the New Testament, the Textus Receptus, the traditional text of the New Testament. And but their rejoinder is, which TR? Because there were several printed editions of the TR. And, you know, some want to talk about, well, let's go all the way back to Erasmus. Let's go back to early editions. And I've said several times, you know, we're really talking about the mature Protestant editions. We're talking about Stephanus. We're talking about Beza, the ones that were used by the eventually the Elseviers, the ones that were used by the Protestant churches in making the vernacular translations. And there are some slight differences in some of those printed editions of the TR. And so Mark Ward is saying, you guys think you've got a more solid, secure textual basis for your preaching and teaching and translation, but you're not doing anything different than the modern critical text. The modern critical text is simply looking at all the extant evidence and reconstructing their texts. You're just looking at a more limited pool. So you're doing the same thing. It's a matter of degree, not kind. And our response back has been, one of the responses back has been, no, it's not an apples and apples comparison. It's an apples and orange, you know, comparison, because yes, we're acknowledging, at least some of us will told to the TR position, that the text is there in the family of the printed TRs, but that's a limited pool, and we're not wide open for anything. And all of those TRs, mature Protestant TRs, have the Pericope Adulterae. All of them have the traditional ending of Mark and so forth. With the modern critical position, they're wide open. It's just like when I had the debate with James White, can you tell me if there's any text in the Bible that you're sure of? And he can hem and ha, and he, in the end, he can't tell me a single verse that he has any confidence in. But anyway, that's so for somebody who might possibly be listening, and of course I've put it forward in a way that's to my advantage, obviously, but that's the basic issue. You think is that a fair description of what the basic issue is with the so-called which TR objection?
I think that's a good way to explain it. But at the same time, I think that Ward's his argument is not just, I think it's a little more sophisticated than, and I'm not saying that you simplified it this way, but it's more sophisticated than you guys are just doing the same thing as us, like a tu quo argument. It is because you're doing the same thing as the critical text people, you are, when you privilege one particular text, like the Scribner or the King James Version, you're making special pleading. It's ad hoc, you know, you're just like doing the same thing as a King James onlyist. And that I feel like is the dagger of his argument, is that it is a way to make an association with a confessional point of view with, well, you guys might be consistent in your theology about it, but then you add this one extra thing where you're just going to like pick one book and make it your diplomatic text. And that's no different than King James onlyism.
Well, and there are some people who uphold the traditional texts who do take that sort of diplomatic, you choose a diplomatic addition, or even somebody like, you know, Doug Wilson, you know, who I don't consider to be a confessional bibliologist, but he said, it's Stephanus. Let's choose Stephanus 1550. And that's it. Or like you said, it might be somebody who simply says Scribner's. That's it. That's the mature edition of the TR and so forth.
I've seen it happen in confessional circles where it's like a debate about, well, which one are we going to pick? You know, which is the right Greek text? And, you know, you might have something that you prefer, but like I've seen people get in this game. Well, I side with Stephanus or whatever. And it's we could easily fall for that trap. It is arbitrary. And I think I try to underline that point that if we do fall for that trap, then then maybe Mark has a point.
Mm-hmm. But you, for those who uphold the confessional text, the traditional text, and who aren't presenting, you know, a single printed edition as a diplomatic text, you rightly point out that in those cases, Mark Ward is conflating confessional bibliology with KJV onlyism. I mean, that's one of the weaknesses of his article. He sort of sets up a straw man of one type of adherent, perhaps, of confessional bibliology, but not necessarily the one that I hold to, for example, or I think that it's the one that's held to by the Trinitarian Bible Society.
Right. So that I think that consciousness, that awareness that, okay, so we don't have a diplomatic text, but we've gone through reflecting that, okay, so there isn't one single text that is privileged above everything else in the TR corpus. I mean, we might prefer one for practical purposes. And then what I suggest is we have to have a prima facie, like, I guess, like, subscription to the Scribner because it's in, you know, we could have reasons why, mm-hmm. but we're not trying to say that that is the diplomatic text. But, okay, so after we've had that point of view and dealt with reflecting upon the modern critique, I feel like that is what I mean by a like post-critical view. It's something that you've gone through the reflection of, okay, so we're not King James onlyist, but why are we not? What is different about it? And that's all I mean by in the article about like a post-critical view.
Yeah, that's, I mean, one of the distinctions you make. I mean, you don't talk too much about what the pre-critical confessional bibliology view might be. I think you make reference to Richard Brash, who's kind of, you know, maybe talked about the pre-critical confessional mm-hmm. bibliology view, John Owen, et cetera. But you make a distinction. Well, okay, you know, for those of us who live on the other side of the Enlightenment and
right.
and the rise of the empirical method and science and so forth, how can we have a post-critical confessional bibliology view that is, you know, intellectually satisfying and reasonable and makes sense in, you know, in presenting good reasons for the believers to accept the traditional text and not the reconstructed modern critical text. You also, I mean, you have some interesting descriptions of things. I think that they're helpful. You talk about the difference, for example, between the micro TR and the macro TR. So what's the, and this is getting back to this whole issue, the which TR question, but what is the micro TR in, as you use the term, and the macro TR?
That's a good question to clarify too, because like in the like hermeneutical literature, even not just relating to the Bible, that kind of language is used, like a micro text and a macro text. And so I feel like it could be overcomplicated. But what I mean by that is that, so for a micro TR, we're talking about a particular text, like let's say Stephanus, or let's say Scrivener, or what have you, or Beza. Each one of those, and each one of those additions that we can point to, that is what I mean by a micro text. And then the macro would mean the tradition of the TR, the corpus, the body of all of them.
And that is an important distinction. Yeah. And, you know, I'm in that, you know, macro TR camp, but I mean, I think they're allies who would pick an addition. And I would see them as allies, and they, you know, I'd be closer to them, you know, ideologically with respect to the text of scripture than I would be with the modern text critics. But you know, there would be a shade of difference as well. So Ward suggests in his book again that these differences in the micro TR, that people who are TR advocates have to deal with these differences in the micro TR. And he says, again, that this is just a matter of degree and not kind with respect to what the modern text critics are doing using the reconstructed method. So what's your response to Mark Ward in your article, or just here, as to why we can't compare the approach of the macro TR with what's being done in modern text criticism?
Right. I guess one of the issues with Mark Ward's paper is that he points out there is one difference that the critical text has, and that's like missing sections. And it's rare, you know, but like really significant that there would be missing sections, and not so much in the TR. If there is a missing section, it's like very minimal.
You mean that there would be a major textual variant, like the Pericope Adulteri or like the ending of Mark? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, precisely. So that is one way that they're like, I mean, you have to concede just on that basis that there is a difference in kind. And his whole argument is, well, there isn't, but he has to concede that there is, but he tries to brush it off a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that's like one of the main issues. I wouldn't say that that's like the nail in the coffin or anything. It's really all about like his rhetoric to say, you know, well, that's not that big of a deal. And he tries to prove his case not so much on that basis, but just saying that there are some similarities. There just might be of differences and variants in both the critical text and from a confessional bibliology point of view in the TR. But it's just a matter of degree. But I guess the fundamental flaw is that he is kind of looking at it from a reliabilist, or like a way of epistemology. He's looking at it from a material evidence perspective, and then using that to analyze the theology of a confessional bibliology perspective. And I feel like that is the major difference. It's more of a methodological difference than one that's a material difference from the different texts.
So some of these terms I'm not as familiar with. So maybe with your philosophy background. So you said you would say he is approaching it from a reliabilist perspective.
Right.
So, what does that mean?
Yeah, just that the evidence that you have to weigh is reliable material evidence that you can like easily access in a naturalistic way. So, for example, number of manuscripts or the actual physical document, the actual manuscript. Those are the types of evidence that you would use, or the text itself, like the number of variants or what the variant is. Mm. But and that's, I think, important to talk about. I try to assess like some of his examples, or all of his examples from his article that he talks about the way the differences between the TR variants and critical text variants. So he gives a few examples from the TR that you would see similar variants in a critical text, just a lot less of them, but they're still the same kind, he's saying, besides the missing sections. But what I'm trying to say is that it's not, from a confessional bibliology perspective, we can talk about those material differences, but there is a more fundamental difference in how we justify our method in weighing that evidence that I think he just misses, or at least doesn't appreciate.
I mean, you did take the time, and we were talking a little bit before we started recording, and I said, you know, Mark Ward did this article in summer of 2020, and I still haven't written any response to it. I've been thinking about doing it. It's just not, I've been a lack of time.
He wants to get a conversation with you about this so badly.
Yeah.
when I was corresponding with him, I was like, yeah, here's what I wrote. Oh yeah, that's great. You know, it would be great as if Jeff could respond to this too. Like, okay.
Cool. Yeah. I know he was on Duane Green's podcast just last week. And several people pointed out to me that he seemed to be, you know, very interested in me having a response to his article. So I might do it at some point. We'll see if time allows. But I mean, you've done a great job. I mean, I feel like you did a lot of the things and said a lot of things I that I might have said. And one of the things you did was you went through his examples, you know, that he gave of some differences in, you know, the micro TR tradition. Here's, you know, how do we reconcile the fact that, you know, there's a one word used in Stephanus's edition and there's a different word used in Beza's tradition, or right. Tyndale chose this translation while the authorized version chose this one. And then how do we adjudicate, you know, what is the proper text and so forth? So you did a study where you went through and responded really to, I think, all the examples that he gave. And I just thought maybe we could just look at least one of those. And one of them was Revelation 11:2. And so can we just take a second, just talk maybe a little more technically for a couple of minutes? I mean, you've got like 10 pages worth in your article. It's not a short article, by the way. It's like 27 pages of text and then a bibliography after that. But anyways, with respect to Revelation 11:2, let me just read it in the AV while we're at it. Revelation 11:2, but the court which is without the temple, leave out and measure it not, for it is given unto the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. So this is when in 11:1, where John is given was given a rod by the angel who says, rise, measure the temple of God and the court without the temple or outside of the temple. And in the discussion, you point out that the question is about whether that it should read outside or inside. So Stephanus has esothen inside, yep. while Scrivener, I'm assuming following Beza, has exothen outside. That's also the reading pretty much sounds like in the English Bible tradition, the Bishop's Bible, the Geneva Bible, the King James Version, and so forth. But Tyndale had followed Stephanus. So we've got a difference. And, you know, ordinarily the authorized version follows Tyndale. You know, I don't know, you know, 90%, 95% that's going to follow it. So this would be a place where Word would say, well, you know, you have to do some textual criticism here. You have to reconstruct it. Is it going to be esothen? He was told to measure the inside of the temple, or exothen, outside of the temple. So right.
This category of difference is probably one of his Ward's strongest points, because what he's trying to say is this is a category of downright contradictions. So you can't say it's exothen and esothen. Those are two mutually different words. You can't have the same interpretation if it's the opposite word. Mm-hmm. And so that's like, this is really important. We got to get to the bottom of this one. It's not something we can brush off and say, oh, it's, you know, it doesn't change. Because most of the examples he gives, it is so trivial that the actual interpretation of the verse is not affected either way. Mm-hmm. And even then, most of the time, Beza and Stephanus have the variant in the margin. So it is unfair to say that they're, the different version of the different texts are like saying different things, because they both give witness to both of the variants oftentimes, most of the time. But here it is like a downright opposite contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about
I think that, let me just interrupt for just a second. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point that you made several times in comparing several of these proposed variances. You make the point that really a lot of times seems like what it comes down to with most of these is Stephanus has one reading and Beza has another. These handful of cases, I'm not sure how many there are, where Stephanus has one reading and Tyndale followed that. And then Beza has another reading and the authorized version followed that.
Right.
And that seems to be, most of the time. But you make the great point that even in Stephanus, typically he has both, he chooses one reading, but he has the alternative in the margin, because it was one of the first, I guess, critical editions Stephanus's was, where he had a critical apparatus. So the point is that there was an awareness in the macro TR tradition of a distinction, of a variant here, we could say, within the TR tradition. But anyways, how do you respond in the end to this? What's your conclusion in the article that you come to with respect to this particular difference in the micro TRs, for lack of a better term?
I look at two different things. First is like the historical information that might inform how we understand what's going on in the architecture of the temple. What do we mean by being outside the gate or inside of the gate? So I feel like that type of information about what court was there for the Gentiles. And that's that issue itself is debated by scholars, but I think like the New Testament evidence kind of gives us a good picture of what is meant by that. I think besides the historical information, most important part is the theology. We have to understand the theology behind what either interpretation. And part of that is understanding how to read the Revelation. It's estimated that like almost every line of the Revelation has an allusion to the Old Testament. And so here, this type of language, I mean, yeah, we have imagery of the temple and the 42 months, and all these things kind of give us a picture. Oh, we're looking back at Daniel. And this eschatology stuff can be a little complicated. So I'm probably not going to dive that deep into it. Mm-hmm. But we have to understand that allusion must inform our interpretation here. Mm-hmm. And I think that it would have to be exothen, the Gentiles outside of the gate, as mm-hmm. opposed to inside, because what is going on here and what the Reformed commentators had thought about this text with great agreement is that we're talking about what is going on with those outside of the true church. They are like, the Reform had an idea, and this is probably not as like fashionable to talk about, to interpret the revelation in these terms, but it's part of our heritage that they had to deal with the issue of the invisible church and the visible church. And it seemed like it was all one big temple, but on the outside is really the false, the Gentiles is an image of not Gentiles after the flesh, but those that are excluded from the communion of faith, those that are not in the presence of God in the inner court.
Careful, Vince, you're starting to sound like a Baptist. That we have to distinguish in the church between the those who are believers and those who aren't. But anyways, yeah.
No, I think it's very important today. This type of stuff is, I mean, I personally deal with this issue. I feel like in Columbus, I feel like I'm right in the Babylonian captivity sometimes. It's just not this type of metro environment. It's hard to distinguish like those inner believers, those that are in the presence of God. It's really hard to judge by appearances. And this picture from Revelation, it really helps helps us wrestle with that, with the Roman Catholic Church. It's has all over its banner that it is the true church, and it has the she has the heritage and the apostolic sanction to be the true church and administer all the sacraments. And that is its claim to legitimacy, is that it has that, it claims it so boastfully. But how is the simple believer to discern, especially during, like, let's say during the Reformation, how do they know? And I think that these pictures that John gives us can really be understandable and intelligible to any believer. As long as they could see that this imagery is borrowed from the Old Testament, they can get that mental picture. And it's, you know, I've seen that. I've seen even Reformed commentators, for example, like Kenneth Gentry, who is like gives a preterist interpretation of this, and just ignoring the theological background and ignoring that this is an illusion and that this is imagery, and trying to say, well, here, this must have been talking about something in the past when the temple was still standing. We're talking about a literal temple here. So we're talking about before 70 AD and is what is referred to in this, but it just kind of ignores the Reform heritage. Like, how has that always been interpreted? There's mm-hmm. been a great agreement that this is a picture of the tension and conflict between the false church and the true church. And I think it has a lot to do with understanding the entire narrative of the apocalypse anyways.
Excellent comments and interesting comments. I mean, to bring it back to this question about which TR, distinguishing between should the reading be esothen inside or exothen outside, when we have Stephanus and Tyndale following with inside, and we have Beza and basically the rest of the English Protestant English Bible translation going with outside. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to compare, you know, Hungarian, Dutch, French. I'm guessing there was probably a Reformed consensus that didn't come through a scholarly announcement or an ecclesiastical announcement, but just simply organically, that exothen was, there was a consensus around that, and that became, you know, the reading, the Protestant reading. And you say, for example, page 16, it is easy to see why exothen became the consensus in the Reformed tradition. And you close up the conversation on page 17 by saying, thus, the lasting textual choice of the KJV translators coheres with the consensus about the meaning of this passage at the time of the Reformation. And, you know, one of the things I said, and I've only, you know, the one preliminary response that I gave to Mark Ward and sort of the which TR objection was that we have to look at all of these on a case by case basis. Right. and examine them, kind of what you're doing, and to say, you know, can we be led to a consensus agreement? I mean, you know, although, like I said, I'm more in that macro TR camp, you know, I'm also unapologetically saying when we have a reading that, you know, becomes basically the mature consensus of Protestants and becomes the mature reading that's embraced in the translations that are made. And, you know, I'm not a KJV onlyist, but let's not overlook the significance of the Authorized Version as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, it had an amazing impact. I just did an interview with a brother in Sweden, and he was talking about, you know, that even they're looking at the Authorized Version, not in a KJV only manner. I mean, they're looking at the Hebrew and Greek, trying to write a Swedish, you know, Reformation Bible. They're actually going back and using the King Carl XII edition in Swedish, which was the Protestant, you know, when the Protestant Bible when the Reformation came to Sweden. But he was saying they recognized that the Swedish scholars at that time didn't have enough Old Testament knowledge, and so they were relying more on the Vulgate and Septuagint, and so they wanted to look and see what have the English scholars done. You know, you can't overlook in the providence of God the fact that the English and the Reformation in England had an outsized influence in the Protestant movement. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
If that makes sense. Well, let's we can move on from this. And I would encourage the listeners, you know, you can read the article, and you can read Vince's responses to all the examples basically that Mark Ward puts forward. And we just looked at one, you know, his comments on Revelation 11:2. You talk about Scribner a little bit, and although you note that you admire Scribner's TR, you talk about the problems with choosing one diplomatic text. And why do you think that's a problem for someone to choose a diplomatic text?
I mean, mostly because it's ad hoc. It doesn't necessarily follow from the precepts of a confessional bibliology. It's something that you could go with the macro text, and that would satisfy all the theoretical requirements of a confessional bibliology perspective. And I think that's also what Mark Ward is implying, is that it is a little bit arbitrary. And if you did just pick one, well, why that one over another? Do you have some kind of special insight outside of that text that gave you that information? Or, you know, how is that any different than a KJV onlyist? And I think that he's absolutely right about that. If we did pick one, and just how do we establish the criteria about that? We could say, well, one was in greater use or that kind of thing. But when you start looking at the information, it becomes problematic to pick one. And then you get targeted and said, well, what about the church before that text? You know, what kind of scripture did they have? It becomes a can of worms, not entirely without like solution. But what I try to say about Scribner in the article is that I entertain the possibility that, and I'm not an expert on Scribner's text. I know people have pointed out that, oh yeah, there are, you know, just, you know, one or two editor errors or something like that. I'm not an expert in that type of study, But I've entertained the possibility because it is in common use and seems to have the look of a final form of a text. Because of those reasons, it seems likely or plausible that it could have because what the when you pick a diplomatic text, you start going from instead of something the text being infallible to give you all that you need to, the infallibility for you to rely on it for all that it's good for, to talking in the language of inerrancy, like this particular text is inerrant. And, you know, so perhaps that is the case. And perhaps it is something that, I mean, not only could you not like verify whether or not every, if you establish a diplomatic text, you can't like appeal to anything outside of that text to like corroborate all the textual choices. But I'm definitely open to say, yeah, it could be without error in an inerrant sense. It could be. But is it needed by the position? I don't think it is.
I think you said this previously, and I know you wrote it in your article. You kind of make the, one of the things you say is, let's go with the macro text. But let's give a, I don't know, what was your language, a prima facie, you know, I don't know, place of privilege for the scriveners and the authorized version, given, we could say, the like you said, that the maybe the historical circumstances and so forth.
Yeah, until we get into any kind of hairy complication where there are a lot of variants or there is kind of like a major choice like that. Revelation 11:2, and even then, like, we're gonna find out that the authorized wins on that point. But it's like you do have to have a practical, functional, working way to access the scriptures. And so that's why, like, yeah, I've got great esteem for Scrivener. It's reliable, you can trust it, and it is infallible for anything you would use the Bible for what it's trying to communicate, what it's trying to reveal to you. You can rely on that. Absolutely. And so but I have to allow that there may be minimal any type of issue in the text would be so minimal by God's providence that it does not in any way affect our certainty about it. We find like questions when we compare micro text in the macro text that make us think, well, which one is it? But like when we analyze those differences, we find that that it is so trivial of a matter that all it is doing is pressing us to guard our custody of the scriptures with even more zeal. And that's like why that's important. That's why those questions are there, but not to really you know, question what the meaning of that verse is, because as we go through the examples that Mark gives, for example, Mark Ward, we find that it's, you know, so trivial that it's not impacting the interpretation of the text. And that's really all that matters in hermeneutics.
And I think, and again, and the confessional bibliology position is fundamentally different from the modern reconstruction method, which must philosophically be open to changing any verse based on new evidence that comes in. So, you know, it's an epistemological foundation of reliability and certainty with the confessional bibliology text versus one that must of necessity philosophically be wide open to anything that might be discovered. You know, they might say, it's unlikely anything will be discovered. I've heard people kind of say it that way. Well, we've probably found everything, but philosophically, you've got to be open to changing everything. That's why James White can't name one verse that he's sure of, because he's got to say, well, I'm open to, there could be a manuscript, you know, unearthed in the sands of Egypt next week that is the oldest and quote most reliable end quote.
Right. It's theoretically built in.
Yeah.
But I think that there is also, when you get away from a reliabilist epistemology about what the evidence is, we're looking at the text as this like very dry thing that we can analyze, but we have to also see it in its native place and function. And that is within the church. Like there are pastors that will guide you through these issues, that it is not just like the Bible is in this vacuum, in this vat to be prodded at. It is something that is alive and that is with the custody of the church. Like the pastors and the teachers of the church, like that is how scripture functions. It's not isolated from the vitality of the church. There are going to be questions, but Christ's sheep are not without shepherds that are sent.
Right. That was one of my responses when I wrote a review of Mark Ward's book, his book Authorized, and talking about how the King James Version is unintelligible. One of the responses I gave to him was, well, you're not meant to sit alone and read the Bible. And you know, you should do private devotional reading of the Bible. If you're a Christian, you should want to read it. But with respect to your understanding and interpretation of it, you have resources. You know, there are many parts of the Bible that are hard to understand, even if it's in completely intelligible English or whatever. There are parts of it you're going to struggle with, and that's where you need the church, right? And you need elders to preach and teach and explain and interpret and draw upon the history of interpretation of a particular passage over the course of centuries and whatnot. We've been talking for quite a while. There are a couple other things I want us to cover. Towards the end of the article, I mentioned you have an interest, and it's interesting to me because you are an artist, on the printed Bible, and you talk about the canonical function of the printed Bible. This is pages 21 through 24 of your article. What do you mean by the canonical function of the printed Bible? How did the print revolution, you think, in God's providence, impact how the Bible is received by God's people?
Yeah, I hinted at this without, it's just hard to like put it all in one sentence when I'm given a summary of it. But yeah, it's so a lot of times we get these like questions about, well, why the Reformation and why the King James Version, and like what is it historically that makes you like settle on one text in a broader tradition? And it just, the charge is that it's arbitrary. But from what philosophy of media, really, how that conversation philosophy has ended up, is that a philosophy of media is really, okay, let me back up just a little bit. So without trying to lose anybody, I'll try my best to make this clear. So philosophy of history is like a main concern in the intellectual tradition. What is the flow of thoughts, and how can we make sense of the changes of ideas and the exchange of ideas over time in all the books throughout the history of, like, let's say the Western tradition or whatever? So they have these things called a philosophy of history. We're trying to make sense of what everybody was saying before us and kind of give some continuity. Maybe some people will say there's a meta narrative, like a broader story or evolution of thought. And then some people say, well, it's all just meaningless anyways. All these challenges of these problems of philosophy, the things that people are arguing and debating about, boil down to language. And that's where things were when modernism came. It became philosophy. Its ultimate goal became the analysis of language, and it became the object of philosophy. Well, in our time, things have changed. The evolution of mass media and how and technology has changed the way people do philosophy. And now philosophy is preoccupied with this obsession with, well, how do we make sense of meaning and ideas? in the world, in the cultural landscape of today's technology. So everything is spoken about in terms of how it is mediated, how knowledge is mediated by our technology, by either images or the internet or through mass publication, those kind of things. So what philosophy of history has become now is we're looking back at the evolution of ideas, but we're not seeing them as independent of the technology that produced those ideas. We now philosophers and social historians, what they're doing is they're saying the ideas and the flow of thought throughout all time also has something to do with the development of writing technology. The books that became mass produced had an influence. The form of the media is just as important as the message that it contains, is the understanding that it's becoming more and more fashionable to think of ideas in those terms. Well, I think philosophy is all just, it is the tools to deal with the church's evolution of theology. That is my point of view as a believer. All that stuff, the secular stuff that people talk about in philosophy books, those are the tools and just the background stuff of what's really important. And that is how the church is maturing in its thought. And theology, we're getting a call. There we go.
Okay.
So theology is not in a vacuum either. It is seated in history, and it is the ideas that are exchanged are also mediated by technology. And this goes back to how the scriptures have been revealed throughout time. I'm not trying to say that it's all an ordinary natural process, because it is all by God's providence. But we see like an evolution of the tools that God wrote first on stone. And then we see like instruments and technology and writing instruments like pens and paper and parchment and the scriptures, scrolls. And then we see like an evolution of from the scroll to the codex. And the codex is like our first book. And what I talk about in the paper is how some scholars have noted that the codex was characteristically a Christian, maybe not a Christian invention, but it was something that was used by Christians. And there are a lot of reasons why that's the case. A lot of it has to do with how books have a sort of linear progression, but they're also indexical. There's something, they're very open. You can flip through the pages really quick.
Find a passage, a favorite passage. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so with a book now, we can see like let's take Revelation. Well, we were saying that almost every line has an allusion to the Old Testament, or we're reading the New Testament and then they're quoting something from the prophet Joel. And then we flip over back to Joel and we're saying, oh, okay. And you can do that with a book. You can't do that with a scroll. There's something in the evolution of the media technology. We see glimpses of this, I try to suggest, in scriptures like Zechariah's scroll written on both sides, the little book, which is like a codex, but like, you know, the diminutive, like it's littler. It's like we see these images of this thing, the book, the Bible. And the Bible is like, what if you think about what is a Christian symbol? You know, you're left with like awkward, you know, what would be the Christian symbol? You know, there's a lot of imagery and symbols, but we're like, tend to like resist this like iconography and this like cute little symbols like fishes and that kind of thing. But like what I've always thought about is like the symbol of Christianity is that beautiful Bible that would sit, you know, in the middle of your family room. And it was just something that you could just open up, and it was something you could tell stories, and it was, or just read straight from it to everybody and have that connection. So there's something very powerful about this object, the book. And once that book becomes in printed form, it becomes mass produced. And then the publishers had to make these textual choices in a different way that had never, they never even had to do when scribes wrote codexes. So there's something very special about all the culmination of things, like the paper and the trade that like led to the paper being brought to the West, the fall of Constantinople, and publishing right in the smack of like this raging spiritual war at right after the Renaissance that led to the revelation, the Reformation. And these things and the evolution of media are not independent from each other. They are very much related. And so like what I'm suggesting is that it's not arbitrary to say that the invention of the printing press is has nothing to do, like it's not an accident of history that that's the Bible that we have. But the Bible gained its in these kind of in the literature that they're talking about, like the form, which is like the actual media of the Bible. It is a book that is printed, and they talk about things like the shape of it, like which books are in that big Bible. All those decisions that all got ironed out when you have mass printing, because now you have to be very clear about which books are in the Bible more than ever, which text, which are the words. And so like that we see from a reform point of view, even back, even from the Reformation, there's like this understanding that there was a very special time when the Bible became the Bible as we know it today. The scriptures have always informed the church, but the actual final form of it had to, it happened in history, and that is not meaningless. And then, so now we're in the digital age. And so that becomes the book, and the text becomes mediated in a different way. And so what I'm saying is that the Bible has stood that, has withstood that change into the new media. It is still, you could easily, it still is indexical. You can, you know, go online and find the Bible and pick the chapter and scroll through the chapter and then pick another chapter. You can, you can flip through it and index it and find things really quickly sometimes with it. There are some advantages, but it is not the full splendor of what we mean by the book. We still take our Bibles to church. You know, a lot of churches, yeah, they do the phone thing, and that's great, but there becomes like some distracting things. It becomes, it's just so mediated that if you ever, you know, people like Mark Ward are all about this technological evolution for the Bible in the digital space. But I'm ambivalent about it. You know, there are some great things about it, but it's not something that you could just, doesn't have that openness, that indexability, that you, you don't want to stare at a screen forever. You know, you can't do the kinds of studies that where you're flipping through page after, you know, making a reference to them, flipping back and forth. It's just not the same kind of study. It's not as enriching. So the Bible still stands. The Bible prevails, but it's, we have to recognize that there was something very special about the text of that time. And now, it, you know, it's not coincidental that in the digital era, that that is where the proliferation of many different versions and texts are happening, because the foundations of it are all under question.
Two quick observations. One is, Craig Evans has an article he's recently written, or it's in a collection of his articles, where he talks about with the invention of the printing press and standardized, you know, printing of the text. He calls it, I think, the beginning of textual fundamentalism. He sees it as a negative, and I hear this in some of the younger evangelicals who are embracing modern textual criticism. They're like, well, you know, the tradition of Christianity has been basically to have all these, you know, not really to know what the Bible is. You know, this community has this Bible, this community has the other Bible, et cetera. And they sort of seems like they sort of see the Reformation, the standardization of the text in printed form as a negative, you know? And I think you know, personally, now we're going back to the philosophy or theology of the Bible, that the inspiration of the Bible and the canonicity of the text was not something that was fluid. It was fixed. There was an inspired text, whether it was recognized, whether it was transmitted properly in various communities and so forth. But then, like you said, providentially, there was a time when it came into a standardized form. That's one observation. Second one is, it's funny, my family devotions, we've been reading together. My family has evening devotions. We often read a book together. We just finished not long ago reading a biography of Spurgeon. We've also been off and on over the last six months or so reading a book called The Techwise Family. And we just read, just last night in our family devotions, yeah, we read this section. And of course, this is a book that's asking Christian families to take caution and how much you buy into technology and so forth. I'd recommend the book. But anyways, there was just a section there where he was talking about, and he posted, he noted a couple of studies where people have talked about the superiority of retaining information when you read it in a book versus when you read it on a screen. And part of that's they talk about the physical phenomenon of holding it. You can remember where it, you know, everybody's had that experience where you read a book and you kind of remember where that paragraph was, where that quotation was. We can't do that on a Kindle, you know.
Right.
It's a holding a book in your hand is a tactile, you know, it's a physical interaction that's different than merely just visually seeing it on the page.
Absolutely.
Anyway, well, we could have a lot more talk about philosophy of media. I want to bring us to a close because I think we've been talking well over an hour. Let's end it with this. Your last line in your article is this. You say this: my hope is that this paper motivates confessional bibliology advocates to maintain their custody of the scriptures with faithfulness and patience with others. So you're addressing Mark Ward, but you're addressing me also. So how would you assess the current state of the confessional bibliology movement? I mean, you've actually been at two important meetings, the one we had in Atlanta in 2019 and the one we had in Wisconsin last year. How do you assess where things are with this movement, if we could call it a movement?
Yeah, I guess it's hard for me to assess things because I feel like it's still too soon to see if this paper has had much of an impact in that kind of way. But I do like occasionally see God's providence working, and I see it in how people talk to each other or talk about other people that might not share the same or hold the same views. I do see that happening, but I guess also I don't really, I got a little disillusioned with some forums of discussing these things. I feel like on the internet places like Facebook, I got a little bit disillusioned, and maybe things have like cleaned up, but I didn't find myself really that edified from some of the internet type
shocking events. You found things on social media that weren't edifying. Just kidding.
Right.
So I hear you. I hear you. I know the tone has been harsh in some settings for sure.
Yeah, I guess if since it is related to this topic of media, I mean, it's probably one place that we can like look at ourselves and clean up. You know, I think that's important.
Cool. Brother, thank you so much for being a guest with me today. I really enjoyed the conversation. How can people follow? Well, first of all, How can they find your article? You have an academia.edu page. And like I said, I'm going to put a link there. And your article is still posted there on your academia.edu page. Is that right?
Yep.
Okay. Do you have some other things there too you've written?
I should have like a philosophy paper or two, one about art, I know, about what I do with the live painting and aesthetics. That would be a way to reach me on there. I'm looking at editing and polishing up that paper because, you know, I'm hoping that interest in this issue does kind of rekindle. And so hopefully this paper has some kind of contribution. You probably might not agree with everything I say in it, but I feel like it can help with the development of these ideas. But you can reach me there. Another way to reach me is just like through my art stuff on social media. And it, like most of my content, that's all it is these days. But you can give me a direct message and you can reach me that way. And if I get anything about theology or anything I've written, I get so excited. So it will not get buried. It's like I'll be weeding through some of the stuff. And I'm not saying that I don't appreciate my art supporters or anything, but it's also nice and refreshing to get someone from the faith that is, you know, even if they're just ready to chew me out and tell me how I made a mistake, because I've done that. I've made a mistake with this paper and had it addressed, you know. So like I love all that stuff. I need that stuff. And I love that kind of connection with my brothers and sisters. So that's definitely another way to reach me, Instagram or Facebook or those types of things.
Do you have a website where you're like, I mean, are you like selling your art, your paintings and things like that? Do you have a catalog of that?
Yeah, I don't offer like a store or things like that. The best way you would want to do that with me, like, is to contact me directly. But as it starts to warm up, I do more shows and gigs, and that's more my thing. So if you want to book me somewhere, I've got like a viral video of my performance art, and I'm, you know, that's like the main thing, is like getting booked for stuff like that.
Send me a link to that, and I'll put that also when I post my article at jeffriddle.net, if you don't mind, send that to me and I'll put that so that people can take a look at the video of what you do in those concerts or whatever. All right, brother. Thank you so much for this time. And I hope that people listening today were encouraged and edified by the conversation. I'm so happy we were able to have this conversation today. And we'll bring this episode of Word Magazine to a conclusion. And I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next episode of Word Magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.